This is the third in our series at Hilchos 101, going back to the basics. Tonight we're going to talk about Bris Milah. And Bris Milah, of course, is one of the, it is the oldest Jewish tradition. It goes back to Abraham Avinu. Abraham was given over the covenant in Bereishis chapter 17. And the covenant asked of him to circumcise himself and the males of his household. And the promise which is given is that when you do this, God says to him, which means that I'm going to be giving you the land of your inheritance, and I'm going to be the God for your descendants. So that is essentially, there are other details in the covenant, but that's what God says, I'm going to do for you. And from the other side, he says, and here's what I ask of you to do for me. What I ask of you to do for me is to bear a mark in your flesh. And why it's here, and the reasons why it's on that spot, the Rambam goes into great detail, Mor Nevuchim, in his chapter about family life. And I'm not going to go into that now, but suffice it to say, there's what to be said. And we can imagine some things, but essentially, this became the mark of the covenant. There's an element of purity. Of course, we know that spot, which is the front of the penis on a male, is utilized in reproduction, and that's one component. And it can also be used, unfortunately, for sin. And so the idea of protecting and being the shomer of the bris, so to speak, was meant to give to the Jewish people to a large degree an element of family purity. Obviously, today we define family purity in a different kind of way with respect to Taras Mishpacha and the rules of Nida. But the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim goes into great detail about that. And the mitzvah is added to, I should say, I don't want to say added to, but it is reaffirmed as a mitzvah in the beginning of Parshas Tazria. Parshas Tazria, chapter 12 in the book of Vayikra, is when we're told the rules of the Yoledes. When a woman gives birth, Pasuk says, Yishaki says, Ria v'yoledah zachar, when a woman gives birth, V'tama'a shivas yamim, she's tumea, she has blood of impurity for 7 days, K'meini das v'satatma'a, v'yomash mini, yimol v'sar l'so. That on the eighth day, that male child needs to have his foreskin circumcised. Okay, so that's what we have. Now the Rambam in his Perush Mishnayos in Chulin, the end of the seventh chapter, he does say that we should never say that we do Bris Milah because it was given to Abraham. Meaning it was a Jewish tradition. It was I don't know, Abraham was a Jew. Abraham was an Ivri. But anyway, it was a Hebrew tradition, certainly through the time that the people were in Egypt. But as we know with the Korban Pesach, if a male was uncircumcised, he couldn't partake in the Korban Pesach. So that's when the Jews made sure to circumcise, for sure. And the Rambam says, don't say that anything that was done prior to the giving of the Torah is done because of whatever family tradition there was. Say that it was done because it was given at Sinai. It was codified at Sinai as a mitzvah. So Bris Milah is one of the 613 mitzvahs, or however many mitzvahs you want to count. There are different counts in all the books that actually count these things. So that's why I think there are certainly more than 613 mitzvahs. We're not going to get into that now. But these are the main sources for it. And of course, it's referenced in a number of times in the Torah, Korban Pesach being the key example of that. Okay, so those are the sources in Bereishis and Vayikra that I wanted to look at. So now we have to know that halachically, there are three elements of Bris Milah. And depending on how you read the Mishnah in Shabbos, which discusses this, would determine whether you think that there are actually two elements or maybe even four elements. So I listed for you the three main ones that everybody more or less agrees to, I should say, certainly in the Orthodox world. And they are Mila, Priya, and Metzitza. There's a chapter in Masechet Shabbos called Rabbi Eliezer de Mila, which asks the question about what do you do differently if a bris falls out on Shabbos. And there Rabbi Eliezer says, you do anything you need to do for Bris Milah on Shabbos. Don't do anything differently. And he says, Malin Paro Nemotzitzin, V'nosdin Aleha Kamen. I'm not quoting precisely because I didn't give you the Mishnah here, but that's why I say that there could be four things. Milah is the removal of the foreskin. Priya is the removal of a membrane which exposes the front part of the penis, which is in English called the glands. In Hebrew, it's called the Atara. And then Metzitza is drawing out blood. And there are different, and that's a big controversy, of course. Mitzitza controversy could be a subject of a whole series that I actually gave a, I gave a class on the Mitzitza controversy this past summer, but that was the Mitzitza controversy of old, because we were looking at historical scandals. Mitzitza, I actually just saw an article this week of new herpes cases which came up, and of course it's always on newborns post-ritual circumcision, and they typically link that to Mitzitza. That's the charge. Some people deny it. I don't want to get too much into that. So Mila is the removal of the foreskin. And the foreskin, if you know, imagine this is the model that I carry with me always. It's my hand and two sleeves. Okay, so you have two sleeves. This is really perfect. Okay, so when my hand is like a fist, so that's like the front part of the, that's like the atara. Okay, I'll use Lashon HaKodesh, okay? It's the atara.
Lahavdil,
right? It's like atara. And then the sleeve of my jacket is the foreskin, is the orla, and the sleeve of my shirt, and imagine the cuff of my shirt, that's the priya, that's the membrane. So the way Mila is typically done is it's done in front of the atara. You have to draw the skin forward. So imagine everything that's in my hand now is the Mila and the priya, as much as possible. People try to grab as much of the priya in advance. And when that is removed, the atara pops its way out like this. And so what you typically have, if it's done really well, is you'll have the skin from the foreskin, the skin where the incision was, a little back. You'll have a little bit of the remains of a membrane here. And that's what it looks like. That becomes the shaft. And and depending on how well the moil is able to remove the priya would determine how much of this is actually on top of the glands. And if that happens, then more needs to be removed. And there are two ways that can be done. Either it could be done through tearing it, which some moils will do with their fingernails, or it could be done with the removal by scissors and whatever other instruments a person might use in order to do that. But the main thing is full exposure. Okay, we want there to be nothing really climbing up on the atara in any way, because that would get in the way of getting the look of circumcision that we are looking for. Mitzitza, as I mentioned, is the idea of drawing away blood, and there are a number of articles that have been written about mitzitza. The first one that I know of in more modern times, let's say, is in the early 1970s. A fellow named Pesach Yehudi Shields, who was a physician, wrote something about the making of mitzitza, and he gave a number of suggestions there as to what the root word, the shoresh of the word mitzitza is. Does it mean to draw? Does it mean to suck? Does it mean to use a sponge when you soak something up? And based on the different definitions, he raised different possibilities as to how what mitzitza is and how it's supposed to be done. And when the Rambam talks about it, he says the mitzitza is done lahotzi dam in mekomos rechokim, to bring blood away from distant places. So what that means, it was a really fantastic article written in the first decade of the 2000s by a physician named Shlomo Sprecher, who unfortunately is now Alav Shalom. He was a relatively young man, but it's called Mitzitza, Hippocratic Vestige, something along those lines, where he brings a number of different suggestions as to why mitzitza became the drawing of blood with the mouth specifically. And he talks, one of the theories which always just struck me and stands out is that when using certain kinds of instruments in the days of real sterility, if they weren't completely clean, the assumption was, and we know this from surgery, I mean, just look at the way they did surgery in the Civil War. Okay, as an example, I remember hearing once by Eddie Davis, who was a history aficionado, saying that Stonewall Jackson was killed because they didn't have penicillin. If they had penicillin, he would have he not only would he have survived, but he would still be alive today. That was his joke. So, okay, but the idea, one of the ideas that he mentions is that there are toxins which were put in, and just like you for a snake bite, you would draw out the poison as quickly as you can. So that was one of the suggestions that he made as to where the idea of drawing out the blood so quickly comes from. And when the Mishnah talks about it, it says, and when the Gemara goes into greater detail about it, it says that a moyel doesn't do mitzitza mavir no so because it's of sakanta. In other words, you take him out of his position because it is dangerous. Now that opens the door to a very interesting question. Is mitzitza done for halachic reasons? Is there a halachic requirement? Or is it done for medical reasons? And if the medical reason changes, or if it becomes no longer really relevant because we have a different understanding of medicine, which we certainly do than the times of the Talmud, then mitzitza becomes something which is perhaps not even needed at all. Forget about method. I haven't even talked about method, but the idea of mitzitza, whether it's needed at all. And I've heard in the name of some you know, I'll tell great rabbis on, I'll just call it the YU side, okay, like Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Hirschel Schachter, who have said that certainly that Mitzitza on Shabbos is not necessary, and whether Mitzitza is even necessary at all is certainly not Ma'akev. Even Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said it's not Ma'akev. Which means that if Mitzitza were not done, you don't go back, open a wound, and draw out blood. You don't have to do that. That's for sure. But with regard to the need for Mitzitza at all, so that's a discussion. And so Mitzitza is done by basically every Orthodox moel today. But the question is the method. How is it done? So usually people in the Hasidic circles and maybe in some Haredi circles, they will actually put the mouth on the baby directly. And people who are not in those groups will typically use either the back of a syringe, a sterile pipette made out of glass, which was invented in the late 1800s, or some other medium so that there's no actual transfer of fluid or saliva from moel to baby or from baby to moel. The Haredi rabbis who were all for that kind of method really came out, like Rabbi Eliyashiv, for example, in the late 80s, wrote a tshuva saying that moels should use a barrier of some kind to prevent the transmission of AIDS from the baby. Because it was a big, in the 80s, that was when AIDS was a really big thing and a really big concern. So they're always worried about getting AIDS from the baby. But what about the moel giving something to the baby, okay? Presumably the moel from guy doesn't have any AIDS, but maybe he has herpes. So that's the source of the big debate over Mitzitza, and I'm just going to leave it at, But the main thing is that the idea of drawing out blood from distant places, again, whether it's medical, if it's medical, then it doesn't need to be done at all, because there's no doctor will say that you need to do this. But if it's halachic, so there are ways to do it which certainly jive on the one hand with halachic requirements of drawing out blood, while on the other hand, with modern sensibilities and sensitivities with respect to sterility, sharing of fluids, and concerns over hygiene. Okay, and it's a big debate today, but we'll leave that for what it is. Okay, the next thing which we have is the question of roles. And remember, we're going back to basics, so even if you know some of these things, I'm going to review them because it's important to hear them out when going through the basics. So the first thing that we have is what's called the Baal Bris. The Baal Bris is, there are three people who are called the Baal Bris, and the reason why this is significant, well, there are a couple of reasons for why this is significant. Number one, people ask all the time, what is the most important kibud, most important honor I can give at a bris? And the answer is there's only one kibud that you can give after you've hired a moel. Okay, and that is the sandik. Because you can't give away the other Baal Bris, which is the father. Okay, that is whether he likes it or not, that's what he is, and that's what it is. So now the father can be the sandik, the father can be the moel, and that would just mean that there is one or two. Well, I mean, it's hard to be the sandik and the moel at the same time. Although I've heard of people who have done it, but I think that's a little much. The father has, in many cases, stood along the side of the moel and helped to do the milah, and therefore he becomes essentially the moel. Well, and there are cases when the father will just be the sandik and he'll hold his baby for the bris. So that's about bris. Why is that significant? So first of all, the main reason is because for each of those people, the day is considered to be a yom tov. And for the most favorite reason that people in shuls love to have a Baal Bris present is, If they're there at the minyan, and the minyan is not when the bris is taking place, it'll be no tachnun. That's a real yantiv. But it really is a yantiv. And so the point is that he's sharing his yantiv with other people. It's just like when somebody's in Shem Brachos, right? It's a yantiv. It's a yantiv for him. And so he's sharing the yantiv with everybody, and therefore tachnun ends up being canceled.
I davened a shul in Yerushalayim once.
The other thing about the Baal Bris is if he's in shul, so he'll typically, either any one of the Baal Bris will get an honor, such as, if it's a laning day, such as an aliyah or something related to the Torah. And there's even discussions in halacha with respect to the priority of, let's say, the moel leading the davening on the day of a bris, and it's only because he's a Baal Bris. Okay, the other roles which we have at a bris, the main ones which are around today, are the Kvater, the Kisei Eliyahu, and the roles of Brachos. And I want to talk a little bit about the history of each of these things, including the Sandek, for a moment or two. because I find it to be rather interesting. And you should know, I have a website, I'm a Moyle, so I have a website called mohelinsouthflorida.com, which is actually a blog, and I've written about a lot of these things, and so all this information is available there. So the question is, where does the word sandak come from? So one thought is that it comes from Greek, that it comes from a word sandikos, but because circumcision is one of the oldest practices, sandak is an argument is made that it's a Hebrew loan word from Greek, as easily can be seen from its earliest appearance in Jewish sources in the 13th century Midrashic anthology of Yalkut Shimoni, where it occurs as sandakos or sandikos with the Greek first declension, nominative case, singular ending. I stole this from somewhere. But I think it's rather curious, since nearly all Greek borrowings in Old Hebrew date to the pre-Islamic period, when Greek was spoken language of the Eastern Mediterranean world. So then sandakos was perhaps in use among Jews for hundreds of years before this, but simply left no record. Its etymology would be from syndikos, which is an advocate in a trial and also a backer or supporter, which makes a little more sense with respect to his support of the baby during this moment, which I'm going to get back to in a moment. So it was a word commonly used in Greek to translate the Latin patronus, which is a Harry Potter word, but we'll leave that aside. But it could also either mean a legal counsel or a social patron, just as the Roman patronus had a moral, if not legal, obligation to assist whomever the person to whom his patronage is extended. So the Jewish sandak was originally thought of, it would seem, as responsible for the circumcised child throughout his life. And that's why some people, when they translate the word sandak, what do they call it today? A godfather. Now that's a mistake, okay, because, you know, we don't bring Marlon Brando into a bris. But anyway, so that is a thought process. I don't know that my objection to that whole theory is that it was the Greeks who banned circumcision. So why would we take a Greek word to prove what, you know, a kibbutz? So there are Jewish sources which are better. One is that sandak is an acronym for Sanegor Nase Dino Kategor. Sanegor Nase Dino Kategor, which means that the defender becomes the prosecutor. And the idea stems from the Zohar, which says when the little boy is undergoing a surgery, the Sitra Achra is broken down and has no power because the bris becomes a litigator against him on behalf of Israel. So think about the role. Of course, the sandak's role is essential, okay, because the sandak is holding the baby from moving. And as anybody knows who's ever done surgery, what you want when you're doing surgery is that your patient is not moving. So nowadays, with anesthesia, that's pretty easy. In the days of the Civil War that I mentioned earlier, how did they get somebody out of? They got the person drunk, and they were doing amputations all the time. I mean, that's a crazy time period in a way of doing surgery. But at least with a baby, it's a little easier to immobilize the baby. But anyway, in a Kabbalistic sense, the Sitra Achra is always trying to find flaws in the activities of the children of Israel, constantly making them the defendants before God. But the bris is so powerful, and the helpful role the sandak plays in protecting the baby and allowing the moyel to do his job changes the keepers of the faith from being defendants against this evil spirit to being prosecutors against him. Imagine, how dare you suggest we're not keeping the law and following God's commandments when you see we begin at the very beginning of life with the covenant of our faith, with the covenant of circumcision. There is a book called the Asher Yesh Yaakov, which suggests that the gematria of the word sandak is 218, plus the four letters, if you add up all the words, so 60, the letters, 60 plus 50 plus 4 plus 100, plus the four letters of the word. That's how you get to the 218. And what's 218? Reach. What's reach? Like reach nichoach. Right, reach nichoach. And so he's saying that this relates, that it's a sweet fragrance, what the bris is. And that relates to what I said before. I said I was going to get back to that the I think it's the Rama who says this, that the Rama says, Kol sandak habe kemaktir ketores, that essentially the lap of the sandak serves as a mizbeach, and he's like somebody who's bringing the ketores, and that's why in Ashkenazic communities, the custom is to share the role of sandak. In other words, if let's say there's a couple and they have baby number one is a boy. I'm just going to assume boys for a second. That's the way I'm counting, even though there could be girls, of course, in between. So they ask one grandfather to be the tzaddik. So when the next son, they're going to ask the other grandfather, or if there isn't another grandfather, they'll ask somebody else to not have the same person be tzaddik for siblings. And that's because of the idea of chadashim laktares, and this is all from the Ramah. He says that you want to have new people doing this. In other words, it's the idea of sharing the wealth. The Sfardim don't follow that. The Sfardim, if they can get the Chacham to be the Sandik every single time, they'll do that. And there are some, truth is, in Ashkenazic, it's not really practiced. I know families who had multiple, many, many boys, and different Sandik every single time. And that is the way that we in fact practice in terms of that. Okay, the next thing is Kavater. Now, Kavater is interesting. Where the word comes from is a serious debate. It may come from a Germanic kind of place. It may come from Yiddish. It may be a diminutive of the word Godfather, right? Because the way that the Germans pronounce it is Gevater, Gevater, which might sound like Godfather. I mean, I don't know if there's a Godfather. Well, it sounds like Godfather, right? But the Gevater is the people who bring in the baby from the mother to the father. Now, of course, knowing the way that the rules of Nida follow, okay, or it's not really Nida, but it's post-birth bleeding. So a woman, technically, halachically, is not really supposed to hand the baby to her husband. So you need to have go-betweens, because she's doing all of her post-birthing bleeding. So you have a go-between. So she gives the baby to a different woman, who gives the baby to her husband, who gives the baby to the father of the baby. And the idea being that this is at least, it's tznius, it's modest, and it's done in a way that that leaves the mother, who certainly once upon a time, may have been resting at home, whatever it may be. Nowadays, every mother that I've ever seen is at the bris herself, with the exception of if she just doesn't want to hear baby cry, then she'll step out of the room. But they're always there. Mothers are always there, and God bless them. That's pretty amazing. So that is, again, it's a debate as to where the, or it's a discussion at least, insofar as where the word comes from. I saw in a book of Minhagei Worms being a city in France, okay, Rashi, I think, had something to do with that. So where they called the Kvater, and this, it's spelled with a gimel, the Gevaterschaft. And what the word shaft means, I looked it up at the time, it means community. So I don't know, what in fact the Gevater shaft was, but maybe it was a community representative of somebody who would bring the baby from one to the other. Anyway, people nowadays, owing to the concept of segula, will often try to give the Gevater to a couple that wants to have a baby. But as I've learned over time and through a lot of experience, that is a very sensitive concern. So it's okay to give a kvater roll, for example, if you believe in the segula, which is fine, to people who have been married a year, let's say. But once you get past a year or 2 years, give some people 2 years, then you really have to ask and say, hey, do you want to be the kvater? Is this something you're looking for? There's some people who, I knew couples who were kvater for 10 years. They were clearly suffering from infertility, and they wanted this segula, that it should be a merit for them. And thank God, in one of the couples I'm thinking about, they had a girl. I don't know what's happened since then. I'm not really in touch anymore. But the point is that it is a sensitive thing. Does the kvater have to be somebody who doesn't have any children? Of course not. The kvater could be any male and female that can have a public handoff from the female to the male, that would be tsanua and proper. So for a long time, this is interesting, for a long time I actually would recommend to people not to, because people ask me, is it okay if we have an engaged couple do this? And I would tell people, no, because we want them to have children, but not yet. Okay? So until I found this, I was reading Naftali Lau Lavi's book. You know Naftali Lau Lavi, Alav Shalom? He is Rabbi Lau's older brother who saved Rabbi Lau's life. Okay? So in his book, he writes the following. On June 1st, 1937, when I was 11 years old, this is Naftali Lau Lavi talking, my youngest brother was born. He's referring to Rabbi Lau, who was not yet Rav Lau. The father was Rav Lau. 8 days later, the great synagogue was festively decorated with flowers. Since early morning, horse-drawn carriages had been lined up near the house. The one decked out with an arch of flowers was to take my new brother to his Brit Milah in the synagogue. All the dignitaries of the congregation were there, along with mothers, family from Krakow, fathers from Lvov and Katowice. My younger brother, Milik, and I got to ride in the decorated carriage of honor together with mother's brother Shmuel and his fiancée, Chana, daughter of Rabbi Elimelech Perlov of Stolen Karland in Pinsk. To symbolize fertility, the couple was honored with carrying the baby to the ceremony, which he would be given, where he would be given a name. Since Shmuel and his fiancée were not yet married, they needed chaperones, an honor given to Milik and me. I'm reading this, like, I'm blown away, because I always assume, no, you don't give it to them. That is inappropriate, but apparently...
And these were kind of chassidic.
Okay, and apparently it was not inappropriate at that time, as long as they weren't observing, you know, a problem of yichud. Okay, so they had these boys there. So I found that to be amazing. Now, the one question which does come up, though, is some people say, I've actually had this many times, where the people who were asked to be the kvater, either they called me or they had the parents of the baby call me. They say, the woman's a nida right now. Can they still do it? Because they can't pass anything to them. I mean, I know a lot of people don't follow those rules, but it is a rule. So some people do. And so my answer to that is two things. Number one, it's nobody's business. And this is a public event. You know, passing a baby with on a pillow is not going to lead to anything. Okay, in public, and they're not touching. Well, I mean, whatever that they're not touching is whatever. But the other thing that I've seen is some communities have either a low plug or they do it this way anyway. Low plug means that they do it all the time, or that when the wife is Anita, that they'll have the husband they'll have the woman take the baby out with two pillows, so she's holding the bottom pillow. And then the husband only takes the top pillow. So that's a solution, but that really only works if you do it that way at every bris. If you don't do it that way at every bris, it's basically saying, Nida, which is also not Sanua. That's nobody's business as well.
Yeah.
Okay, next we have the Kisei Eliyahu. So this is an important, it's an important role. People ask me, is Kisei Eliyahu an important role? So it depends on how you view the Kisei Eliyahu. Now, I'm not going to be the person who says that it's not an important role. It's a short role. Most honors at a bris are holding the baby for a short time, with the exception of when the baby's given his name, and I guess the sandik as well, but the sandik we've already talked about. So Kisei Eliyahu, somebody places the baby on a chair, which is designated as the chair of Eliyahu. So just like at a Seder, we designate a cup for Eliyahu. At a bris, we designate a chair for Eliyahu. Ashkenazic tradition is to designate a separate chair. So you have a chair for Eliyahu and a chair for the Sandik. And the Sephardic tradition uses the same, and Middle Eastern tradition uses the same chair, where they'll call it, this is the Kisei Eliyahu, and we put the baby on it, and then the Sandik sits on the same chair. Okay, it's a kind of honor which is done. But now, why do we designate it? So it basically goes down, it's the same reason why we do Pesach. And by the way, Pesach and Milah have a couple of things in common. Number one, they're both the only two mitzvahs I say, positive commandments of the Torah, that if you don't do them, chi of karis. Okay, karis is cutting off from the people, whatever that means. There are different definitions of what karis is. And they also have other connections in that if you are not circumcised, you can't, at least a male, if you're not circumcised, you can't participate in the Karban Pesach. They both have an element of blood in them. At least the original Karban Pesach was putting the blood over the doorpost. And of course, there has to be blood at a bris, which is one of the reasons why there's controversy over what kind of bris instruments, medical instruments, or circumcision instruments are utilized if they cause a bloodless circumcision. There's a big controversy. Can you even use that? Okay, so we'll leave that aside. The pasuk that we say at a bris is "Va'omar lach b'damayich chayi." Right, what is "b'damayich chayi"? That through your bloods you shall live. What are the bloods that through which you shall live? The blood of Mila and the blood of Pesach. The Jewish people were saved on account of the blood of the Karban Pesach. At least the firstborns were saved, and then they left Egypt the next day. So there are connections between the two, between Pesach and Mila. But Eliyahu Hanavi, the story that goes on, that is recorded in the book of Malachim, Malachim 1, chapter 17, is essentially when Eliyahu runs away from the Jewish people. There's a price on his head, and he has to go so far that the Navi tells us that he goes to Har Chorev. What's Har Chorev? Har Chorev is Har Sinai. So he's basically having his own kind of encounter with God, and in that place where the Torah was given. And essentially Eliyahu says, when he's asked by God, why are you here? Malach HaPo Eliyahu. Eliyahu says, the Jewish people have forsaken you, they've abandoned the covenant, and it's all over. And God says, no, they haven't abandoned the covenant. And our tradition is that Eliyahu bears witness to the covenant, the bris, every single time. And the way that we acknowledge that Eliyahu bears witness is through giving him a chair.
We invite him there.
Okay, we invite him there. And that's one of the reasons, since you mentioned the word invite, that people who are in the know actually don't invite people to a bris. Why do you not invite people to a bris? Because if Eliyahu Navi is going to be present,
how can you say no?
How can you say no? And so we just say, the bris will be at such and such time. Please let us know if I'll be showing up. No, they don't. Okay, but they don't want to invite people. They don't want to put people in a situation where they may come to insult Eliyahu Navi. Okay, so there is there's also another significant connection between Eliyahu HaNavi and Pinchas. We have a tradition that Eliyahu was a reincarnation of Pinchas, and Pinchas also plays a role in being the defender of the covenant. And so there's a connection there as well, because we mentioned Pinchas at the beginning of the bris when we say the first few psukim of Parshas Pinchas. So, okay, there is one more thought that I just want to share with respect to Eliyahu's presence, which I heard in the name of Rabbi Menachem Gnack, that Eliyahu's role is the guardian of the Mesorah. He represents authenticity, the link in the chain back to Moshe, Kanokinesi. So therefore, he shows that at a bris, when we bring a newborn into the covenant, he is the one who is mitaritz kushios v'abayos, right? When the Gemara talks about Tishbi, Teku, Tishbi, mitaritz kushios, Eliyahu is going to answer all the questions. He's the link back to the Mesorah. He comes to the Seder, as I mentioned, which is the passing of the Mesorah from one generation to the next, and he's also the one who's going to bring Mashiach, right? Eliyahu HaNavi lifnei ba yom Hashem ha'gadol v'hanara, and so he is an important connection in the link of the chain of the Jewish people from the time when he first existed until the future. So we wanted to bear witness to all that. Okay, the brachos roles, so that is not, again, it's not, I wouldn't say that they're highly significant, either those who say the brachos or those who hold the baby. However, I will tell you about an experience which I had, I think at this point it's about 2 years ago, which was really instructive to me. Some people like to say that the holding of the baby during the brachos and the naming is called a standing sandik. So that's a nice way of saying, okay, grandfather one, you'll be the sandik during the bris. Grandfather two, you'll be the standing sandik. And it's not, it definitely doesn't have the same schmaltz, and it doesn't have the same, you know, oomph as the regular sandik, but nevertheless, that's how some people couch it. And this is what happened. So I will name babies a lot at a bris, and I, you know, try to do it nice, but would often go through it quickly. I was at a bris where the baby's uncle, somebody who's like, you know, a little kalbachi or kind of, you know, into just, you know, sing. So he didn't sing it, but what he did was he took it very, very slowly. And he just took his time, every word with kavana, not very long, but just a different kind of nice. And I said to him afterwards, you know, I read this all the time and I go through it, and it was just touching the way that you did it. And he said to me, I'm announcing a new name of a Jew in Klal Yisrael. How could I rush through it? And I thought that was
very meaningful.
A very meaningful thing to say. And it made it a little more, certainly made it a little more significant. I mean, I didn't think about it, but there you go. And I don't know how much I've slowed down, but sometimes when I think about what he said, I definitely do take it a little slower. But there is that element, so much so, and it's also a very emotional moment at times. I've seen people who name the baby, if the baby is named for somebody who was important to them in their own life, that they fall to pieces, which is why I often tell parents, if they say, I want my father to name the baby, I say, okay, what's your father's emotional attachment to the name that you're going to be giving to the baby? So if they say, oh, he's going to fall to pieces, I say, I highly recommend you have your father hold the baby while somebody else names the baby. But if they tell me, no, my father's a rabbi, he's a pro, you know, he'll, or whatever, he doesn't have to be a rabbi to be a pro, I say, okay, fine, if you can hold it together and then fall to pieces afterwards, I have no problem with that. But during the naming, it should flow. So there is significance. There's certainly an emotional significance, and there is there can be beauty in that moment. I think more for the person who's holding the baby, in my opinion, than for the person who's actually naming the baby. But that's, you know, I guess that's a matter of opinion. Okay, special circumstances. Special circumstances. So I gave you five bullet points. A preemie, a baby with jaundice, no foreskin, strange foreskin, and hemophilia. So we'll go in that order. So if a baby is premature, so it boils down to a couple of simple questions. Is the baby, first of all, how big is the baby, I would say? And of course, is the baby healthy? So Miles, for whatever reason, I never really got to the bottom of this, not that I researched too hard, but in America, they look for a magic number of the baby being 5 pounds. In Israel or in other places where they measure by kilograms, they look for a magic number of, I think, whatever, it's the equivalent. It's like 2.3 kilos or 2.5 kilos, which is a little more than 5 pounds, before they do a bris on a baby. That's not to say that a baby under 5 pounds can't have a circumcision, but the main thing that you have to know is that the baby needs to be in perfect health in order to do the bris. That's why if a baby gets sick in any way, the bris is pushed off, and depending on the nature of the illness, the bris might be pushed off for an entire week from the time that the baby is healed. Okay, it's called Shiva Yamim Eis La'Eis, and it's based on a very simple question that I ask people, which is, if we hadn't treated the baby, what could have happened? Okay, now nobody likes to say, but of course, if the baby could have died without having that treatment, that's a systemic problem, and therefore, from when the baby is cleared medically, and thank God, I've never seen a baby not get cleared medically, you know, when it wasn't a really early preemie, yes, I've seen some of those not make it. But when a baby, you know, they caught something, the baby had fluid in the lungs, the baby had an infection. Thank God, I've never seen a baby not make it to his bris. So it's just a question of time. So if it's systemic, we wait 7 days from the baby gets cleared. And if it's non-systemic, it's just something that they were monitoring, it might not push the bris off at all. The only thing which might push off a bris by days, but it's not considered officially systemic because it's something which works itself out on its own, is the next item on our list, which is jaundice. Okay, now jaundice is a much larger topic, but a doctor could probably explain it a little better. But I will tell you that it's more than likely that a lot of the stuff which we understand or fear regarding jaundice is a misunderstanding of halacha. Halacha talks about babies that are red and yarok. Now, what's yarok? Yarok could be green. It could also be yellow. It could also be blue. Now, if a baby's blue, we have a problem. If a baby's yellow, I mean, because the Gemara uses the word yarok to describe different colors in different contexts. But if the baby's green, what's a green baby? That's a baby that's really not ripe, like a banana, right? But if the baby's yellow, so what does that mean? So there are different kinds of jaundice, for sure, but the most common jaundice is normal physiological jaundice. And unless the way that they tell you how much or how extreme the jaundice is by checking the bilirubin count, okay, which is a simple blood test, but ask parents who've watched their baby get heel stuck so many times, if it's simple, and they'll tell you, I hate it. They hate getting this. It's the worst. It's the worst. Like they hate the heel stick more than they hate the bris. I'm talking about the parents. Forget about the baby. Okay. So anyway, there are some males who are a little more strict about it, and some who are less strict. It just basically means that the kidney isn't mature enough in processing the blood in the way that it's supposed to, so that things should be absolutely 100% normal. But every moil is a different thresh point. What's that word? Threshold of where I'll do the bris versus not. Okay, so I know there are some people who have told me, because I don't consult with a lot of moils about this stuff, but that there are some moils who, if the baby's numbers are over 12, they don't do the bris, and therefore they never do a bris on time. Okay, in the 20 something years that I'm doing this, I have maybe had fewer than 10 bris is pushed off on account of jaundice, because in most cases the numbers are going down, and I'll do a bris when the bilirubin count is 16 or lower, and in most cases it spikes at day 4, day 5, but by the time day 8 rolls around, it has gone back down. And Baruch Hashem, I've never had a problem. So with respect to that. Okay, next question. No foreskin. So this could happen. It's funny that, not funny, but in our tradition, there is talk about certain biblical figures like Noah, who was born without a foreskin, and I think Moshe was born without a foreskin. I don't remember all the ones who were born without a foreskin. And in those traditions, they say, oh, it's a very holy thing. Now, there might be some people who will view that holy. Some people say your baby was born with an abnormality, okay, and he can't really have a bris. So what is done with a baby that does not have a foreskin at all? So it really depends. Sometimes the baby will not develop a complete foreskin, but will develop a partial foreskin. Or there's some kind of skin that's there that needs to be removed. So if that's the case, then you could do a mila with a bracha and all that in removing whatever is present that should not be there, just to get the same kind of result that we're looking for. If there's nothing to be removed, then we do what's called hatafas dam. Hatafas dam means a ceremonial pinprick, and there's a debate whether a bracha is made over this. Although I did find that if a child is born without a foreskin and hatafas dam is performed, there is no tachlim. So a lot of people will like that. Okay, that's very important. Okay, now if there's a strange foreskin, so I mentioned that already. Partially, I mentioned that already. It really depends on what the strange foreskin means. There are different kinds of conditions that babies can be born with based on how things develop in utero, which has nothing to do with the baby, and it's not a poor reflection on the child. But in some cases, it's genetic, and I know this, okay, because I once had the opportunity to do a bris for a baby that had a condition called hypospadias, where the hole where urine comes out of was not where it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be at the center, and it wasn't. So there are different degrees of hypospadias where it could be a little off in any direction. In extreme cases, it could be further up the shaft on the top, or in the most common case that I've seen is that it's the very bottom of the glands. Okay, there are even worse cases where it's on the scrotum, which is crazy. But all of these cases just means that inner tubing needs to be rewired, and that, of course, is an extensive surgery. And a moil shouldn't really touch that. If it's anything a little off center, it's probably fine. And most doctors will even tell you it's fine. But if it's down here, the baby can never be a father, okay? And if it's down in the scrotum, the baby can never urinate like a man, okay? So those things do require surgery. So I did a bris once on a baby, and I had checked beforehand, but discovered afterwards the kid had a mild case of hypospadias. The spot where that's supposed to be the hole was actually a dimple. And the hole was somewhere else, which was only discovered after the foreskin was removed. So years later, the mother of that baby was now in a different marriage, had a baby who had a case of hypospadias, a lot more extreme, and it was clear from beforehand it was not going to be bris; it was going to be a surgery. And when that, I remember her saying to me, "It's got to be me. It's my genes because how else?" So, which makes a lot of sense. Okay, so that is what it is, and that's fine. But the point is that if the baby requires a surgery, then the best thing is for the moil to not touch. And if it's possible, the best thing I think is to get a Jewish surgeon. Even better, a from Jewish surgeon who will do a bracha and he'll do it all b'shem u'malchus and he'll do it for the sake of circumcision and he'll do everything right. Okay, if not, then I've been present in the operating room where they allowed me to draw a little bit of blood or to participate, you know, in the tiniest way so that a bracha can be said and so that at least the religious component of the circumcision could take place. Okay, the last thing here is another element in just the Jewish history of conditions which, while we certainly have hemophilia today, but we also have ways of treating hemophilia today. And so, well, once upon a time, the halacha talks about if a baby had a bris and then he died, and then his mother has another baby later who has a bris and then dies, then the next boy that she has is pater, is exempt, never needs to have a bris. Now that is an argument which people who are anti-Jewish circumcision use to say, you see, you can have a Jew who's not circumcised, clearly. Yes, but the price that we have to pay in order for that Jew to be uncircumcised is not a price that anybody wants to see. So yes, it's an exception, but it's a very specific exception to a rule which probably related to the idea of not being able to deal with bleeding post-circumcision on a baby who had hemophilia, okay, as opposed to, you know, a moil who was incompetent and just didn't know how to stop bleeding, which is a different subject entirely. So I have never heard of a story, nowadays, Not that it can't happen, but I've never heard of a story of a baby dying from a bris with hemophilia. Usually they even know about it beforehand, or they can know about it beforehand. People know about it if it's in the family, genetics, whatever it may be. And so there are precautions which can be taken so that a baby can be circumcised under those kinds of circumstances. Yeah?
There's another special circumstance. Mm-hmm. You have the preemie and you have the other things. But what if the baby's born full term, good weight, but he's got all kinds of other medical issues?
So it depends what those medical issues are. Typically, again, it depends. So if it's the kind of stuff which clears, then we would wait until they clear. If it's something which is a kind of medical issue which is never going to clear, so then you do it at the right time. Or if you can never do it because it's unsafe, then you don't do it. Okay, I mean, I'll just give an example. If a baby has Down syndrome, can he be circumcised? Yes. Okay, you might have to wait a little bit of time. But that's something that's a medical condition that's not going to clear. That is what it is. Right. So yeah, I mean, it depends on what the circumstances.
A friend of mine is just going through this right now. Uh-huh. That baby's born with cleft palate. Something's wrong with his ears.
Right. So I'll give you an example. Again, and this boils down to putting it into the parents. It's their choice. They have to do what is best for their baby, and that's something which I would emphasize every single time. So there, one of the cases of hypospadias Let me rephrase. There's a baby that was born with a hernia or even a double hernia, and the parents decided we are not having our baby go through two events. So we're not going to do the bris until the hernia operation, and then you'll be in the operating room and you'll be present. And once the baby's out, they're going to take care of everything. Okay, I would have advised against that because I think the baby could have had the bris, but they didn't want to, so they had it all done in the operating room. Okay, so that's what some people do. So if, depending on what they're dealing with, they might say, you know, bris is last on our list. Would I advise that? You know, I don't know that I would advise it. I said, you want to do the bris? I mean, there are people who go meshuggah to make sure the bris is not delayed. So here are the people who are opting to make sure the bris is delayed. One of the things that the Rambam talks about, Mor Nevuchim, he says, you know, one of the reasons why we do the bris so early is because if the longer we push it off, the more people wouldn't do it at all, and then they'd be forsaking the covenant. Right? Imagine if we had to do this on a one-year-old or a two-year-old. People would not be as quick. You know why? Because the baby is very unaware. The baby has a very short-term memory. As soon as pain is over, the baby's fine. The baby heals very quickly. You don't even need to do stitches. Whereas if you do it on a one-year-old or a two-year-old, a totally different ballgame. Totally different. I know from doing brises on 3-month-old, I tell the parents, what do you wait for? You know, they're usually either not observant or not even Jewish. Like, what do you wait for? And they said, we weren't sure if we wanted to do it. Okay, well, next time, decide earlier for your baby's sake. Don't, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting points in halacha. Fast days. So we actually mentioned one of these in shul the other day because we're learning Hilchos pre-Purim, where one of the interesting circumstances is if there's a bris on a pushed off Tinus Esther. So Tinus Esther's Purim is going to be Sunday. Tinus Esther is now going to be Thursday. And there's a bris on that day. Does everybody, can people eat? So usually a pushed off fast, for example, the Moel, the father, and the Sandek for sure can eat. And then they don't have to make it up. The Ramah mentions that if it happens in that circumstance, I think it's the Ramah, if not it's the Mishnah Berurah, who says that if it happens that way, everybody who's present at the bris on that Thursday can eat. So then there's a debate whether the people who were present need to make up the eating, the fast rather, on Friday. Okay? There's another opinion that they can't eat and they should all break their fast on Thursday night. I once had a bris on that circumstance and I told the father, I said, you can have everybody eat at the bris according to the first opinion in the Ramah. And he said, I'm not doing it. So they had the bris in the morning and then he invited everybody back for a break the fast, which was delicious. Okay.
We went to Tisha B'Av fast, Tisha B'Av bris.
Yeah.
And it was held at night.
All right. So, okay. But the bris has to take place during daylight hours. So it may have been the food which was at night. Yeah. Okay. Another interesting point. So anyway, with respect to fast days, another thing which is interesting is that you know how there's a custom to give wine to the baby at the bris? So I found out, and I think that this is correct, that that originates from if a bris takes place on Yom Kippur. Because on Yom Kippur, so normally a woman who has just given birth does not have to fast, except for Yom Kippur. Okay, so on Yom Kippur, so you might say on any fast day, well, who's going to drink the wine? We have to make a bracha over the wine, so you give it to the mother, no big deal. But on Yom Kippur, you can't give it to the mother, so who are you going to give it to? The baby. The baby's right there. So you give it to the baby. Now, there's probably a lot to the idea that if there's alcohol in the wine, that it might be a little, you know, it might knock the baby out a little bit. A lot of babies take a nap after the bris. But there is that component as well, because we give wine to the baby basically at every bris, unless the, you know, I've met a few mothers who would say, there's some mothers who's like, get my baby drunk, I want him to have a lot of wine. And some mothers who say, I don't want my baby drinking anything other than breast milk, I'll have a bottle pumped and whatever it may be, and that's how we'll give to the baby. Okay, to each their own. Bein Hashmashos is on Friday. This is interesting. What happens if a baby is born after sunset on Friday, but before nightfall? Okay, so when is the bris? That's the question.
Shabbos?
It's a good question, right? Yeah. When is the bris? So after Shkia, so is it Shabbos? You're in an area of what's called Suffolk. It's a doubt. We start Shabbos early because we don't know exactly the precise moment when Shabbos really begins. There is a moment in time when Shabbos begins, but we start early to be on the safe side. It could be that it starts a little later. So we're in an area in time which is called Suffolk. So what happens is, according to the Ashkenazim, when will the bris take place? Well, it might not be Friday anymore, so it can't be Friday. But because we have a doubt as to whether it actually is Shabbos, the bris is going to take place on Sunday. Okay? According to Hasidim, Bein Hashmashos, it's still Friday, so they'll do the bris on Friday. And I don't remember if there's an opinion that says it would be on Shabbos. Okay, I don't remember. Okay. Anyway, that's interesting. Tachnun, I've talked about that the idea of not saying it is something which is significant. However, you should know that it's not so simple, because the big question which comes up is to how far does the non-recitation of Tachanun go? So let's say there's a shul which has a lot of minyanim. There's a bris taking place at one minyan in that shul. Does every shul in the building avoid Tachanun? There are differences of opinion. I'm not going to pass in on that now. It's a longer discussion. You can have a shir on Tachanun and the day of a bris, you know, just that. What happens if the bris is going to take place in the afternoon? Okay? So the Bali bris I mentioned before, the Moel, the father, the Sandek, they would cancel Tachanun. But what if the bris is going to take place in the afternoon, and then and they're going to daven Mincha afterwards? They say Tachanun at Mincha. What happens if Mincha takes place before the bris? Do you say Tachanun? So you likely don't say Tachanun at Mincha before the bris, but after the bris, that if Mincha is after the bris, so that's an interesting question. And that is certainly a discussion as well. There's a lot of stuff on it in Shulchan Aruch, Aruch Chaim 131, and you're encouraged to look there and figure that out. Okay, closing words. Bris Milah is something which is fraught with controversy. We know this from the earliest times of the Jewish people, when the Jewish people were attacked, and the edicts against them, certainly we know about it in the time of the Greeks, with the Maccabees, was anti-circumcision. And today we have people who are as well anti-circumcision. Some are anti-circumcision for all, and some just don't like Jews. And thank God we have Muslims who circumcise as well. So when people start attacking religious circumcision, they can be called Islamophobic, and nobody wants to be called Islamophobic. So there, at least you can say you're attacking religion.
Anti-Semitic is okay.
Right, anti-Semitic is okay. They don't care if you're called anti-Semitic. But once you're attacking religious circumcision, you're also attacking Islam. And therefore, you could say you are Islamophobic, and that usually shuts that down often. But for people who are against medical circumcision, and therefore against all circumcision, so you can't say Islamophobic, they're saying, no, I'm protecting babies. And that is a big controversy that exists today, even in America. Thank God, any time people have tried to make a law banning circumcision, it has been shut down. The medical community is kind of on the center with respect to circumcision, where they say it's fine, it's very safe, and it's okay to do, but they'll stop shy of recommending it. Okay, in other words, they're not going to say you must, or we say that everybody should, but they say it's fine to do. Okay, the other point that I wanted to make, and this is the footnote, this is one of my favorite quotes, Hermann Wouk. Shalom just passed away this year or last year, at the age of 103, I think, or 104. So he, one of his earlier books, which describes his own religious journey, is entitled, This Is My God. and he has a chapter in there on circumcision, in which he makes a funny joke about Voltaire, which I'm not going to, you have to look it up. But towards the end, somewhere in there, he says, for Jews, circumcision is not a detail of hygiene, but the seal of the pledge between Abraham and his creator. The Jews have followed the Mosaic law with confidence, which modern medicine progressively ratifies. The medical endorsement is not, however, the glory of Judaism. It is a footnote. I love that quote because it just summarized very perfectly that we are not doing this because it's cool or not cool or accepted or not accepted. We're doing it because it's a footnote to who we are. And who are we? That's the last bullet point on the page, which is we are the people of the covenant. Anytime somebody has ever come to me or I tell them about, you know, I have a Facebook page, I have a website which gets attacked by these anti-circumcision people. Anytime I've ever told it to people, their reaction is always the same. These Meshuggahs, they don't know who we are, and they don't understand anything about us. And that's true. And that's true. And there's something about the covenant that the Jewish people who have bought into it say, and the Gemara talks about this, that anything that the Jewish people were willing to give their lives up for, preserve them. And what is the first thing that the Jewish people were willing to give their lives up for? Well, it's Bris and Shabbos. Those are the two. And that is what has defined us as the Jewish people. So we can wax on for a long time about the significance of the covenant with which I opened, about our connection to God and God to us. But that, in the end of the day, that is the bottom line. That is what drives us. And that is why, just like Pesach, which I mentioned earlier, the clearly, to me, the widest spread practice amongst Jews of all stripes and colors, other than the Pesach Seder, is Bris Milah. And that is, and sometimes, you know, I look at the people who are doing a Bris, and they're specifically seeking out, not a doctor, they're seeking out a Moyel. And not only that, an Orthodox Moyel, or a Hasidic Moyel. And these people have nothing to do with anything, but they want to do it right. Why? It's in our DNA. I don't know how else to describe it, because there's no rhyme or reason why the people that I'm describing, and I'm not knocking them. I mean, God bless them, amazing, right? That they might be so far removed, or they might be Tinag Shenishba, right? People who just know nothing about Judaism, but this they know, and they're willing to get all the bagels and the lax and the shmir and whatever it is they're supposed to get, and they want it done right, and they want the certificate that proves their kid is maybe they think that it's what makes your kid Jewish. The kid's Jewish if the mother's Jewish, but this is who we are. So this is one arena where I think that Orthodox Jews can learn from people who are not Orthodox. And whether they understand completely what the covenant is all about, they know that this is a defining element of the Jewish people. And for whatever reason, that has stuck through. So we probably, you know, might have a higher level of appreciation of the covenant of the Jewish people. We, you know, we study the Chumash. We know Avraham Avinu very well. We know the mitzvah of after the Yoledes gives birth to a boy, that he needs to be circumcised. And we understand the concept of the covenant that Pinchas defended, and that Eliyahu defended, and that all the people throughout the generations defended. But this is who we are. This is the first and foremost definition of the Jewish people, Avram's covenant with God, sealed at Sinai as well, in the mitzvah, a defining moment of the Jewish people. That is who we are, that's what we stand for. And it begins with Bris. And as we bless every child at a Bris, just as he entered the covenant. What does it mean, just as he entered the covenant? He entered the covenant because his parents brought him into this world, and they said, you're a Jew. And just as they guided him to this point, not guided him, I mean, they're blessed to have him, but they should be blessed to always be able to transmit to him that this is who we are as a Jewish people. And that's the blessing which we give to all children and to all parents, that the covenant should be something that we value and that we cherish, because it is one of the key defining elements of the Jewish people. Yeah.